In courts in both Kansas and Missouri, judges and social workers are facing a spike in the number of child abuse and neglect cases. But why? Researchers are currently seeking those answers, with some pointing to the economic downturn. But what can be done to help children facing these issues in Jackson and Johnson County? I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll learn about a growing need for court-appointed special advocate volunteers in our area. We'll be joined by directors of our area CASA organization, and stick around for the second half of the show when we chat with an artist from South Africa working with another local artist to create artistic programs for young people in the Kansas City metro. That's ahead on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. There are so many stories of child abuse and neglect, locally, regionally, nationally, and internationally, that it's easy to get numb. Some people hear and see these stories, though, and choose to get involved. Our guests today say getting involved is more important than it's ever been, with reported cases of child abuse and neglect on the rise. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. And joining us today are CASA Court-Appointed Special Advocate Executive Directors Martha Gershon of Jackson County and Lois Rice of Johnson and Wyandotte Counties in Kansas. Welcome to Central Standard.
Thanks for having us.
Now, from 2007 through last year, new cases of child abuse and neglect rose from 365 to 561 in Johnson County and 859 to 970 in Jackson County. What's happening here? There's been a spike. What do people think is the cause of this?
Well, there have been a number of studies that have shown that as the economy has gone down, and that's certainly been happening over the last several years, the incidence of child abuse unfortunately goes up. The stress that families face, oftentimes economic stress, has such a ripple effect that it causes families, parents to make decisions that they might not otherwise do. And unfortunately, the children in the home are oftentimes the ones that suffer the effects of that.
That's not necessarily an exact science on the economy, but one of the many causes, one of the many factors?
Definitely.
Tell us what the CASA program is about and how you help offset some of this child abuse and neglect.
CASA stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates. And we recruit and train the volunteers who are assigned one-on-one to work with the children who are under court supervision. So that means when a child has been abused and neglected, when they've been removed from their home, when the court has taken jurisdiction, if they're lucky, in a pretty unlucky situation, they're appointed a CASA volunteer. That's a volunteer from the community who commits to knowing the facts about the case, to visit the children in foster care, and to stay with them through the duration of the case so that the judge who has to make decisions about their placement, where they're going to live, what services they get, has real information, has the facts.
What role does a volunteer play in this whole duration of the case in helping the judge make decisions?
Well, they play the most direct role of all. They are the ones who go and visit the child wherever they're living. So if they're in a foster home, if they're living with a relative, if they're in a treatment facility, that CASA volunteer meets with that child on a regular basis, anywhere from every week to every month, get to know how they're doing, what their needs are, what issues they have. They also talk directly with the people that are involved with the child. So that certainly includes any school personnel, medical personnel, mental health therapists, any of those people who have information about that child and what their circumstances are and what they need in order to do the best they can and to thrive. That volunteer is the one who's firsthand gathering that information.
How much time does a typical volunteer spend with a child, and what do they actually do when they're spending that time?
We talk about this as extreme volunteering, and that's because it's a real commitment one-on-one to help a kid or a couple of siblings who are placed together. Our volunteers tell us that it typically takes 6 to 10 hours a month to do the work that we ask them to do. They spend some of that time visiting the child, a little bit what Lois was talking about, going into the foster home or the hospital or the residential treatment facility, or maybe the kids are placed with a grandmother or an aunt and uncle, visiting the children, being sure that there's food in the home, that they have a bed to sleep in, that they're not being re-abused in some way, that the place that they've been put is also safe for them, and then learning about their needs. So for a school-age child, that might mean attending a special education conference. For an infant, it might mean getting the records from the Children's Mercy neonatal unit. We ask our volunteers to be the private investigator, to be the one person who knows what these children need and can provide that information to the court so that they're not making information off of a bunch of pieces of paper in a file folder, so that they really see a picture of these children and what they need. A lot of these kids are in the system for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. If there isn't a CASA volunteer sticking with them side by side, hand in hand, there isn't usually a single adult who knows everything about the case and can really help.
So who at the court are the CASA volunteers liaising with?
Well, they're with the attorneys who are involved in that court case. So it would be the guardian ad litem attorneys. Those are the attorneys who represent the children. So that's their most direct court contact.
And our volunteers provide this information. Sometimes they are able to speak in court. Sometimes that information is presented in writing. But our judges and commissioners tell us that the most important information they get on every case typically comes from the CASA volunteer.
What is it about children who have come into contact with CASA volunteers that tends to make a difference? What are the measurable results? Are they in the system for the same amount of time as children who don't have CASA presence? What's the payoff here?
Well, the payoff is very, very dramatic, and it definitely is a benefit to the children as well as a benefit to the entire system. Children with a CASA will spend less time in the whole foster care court system. So the fact that they're in care for less time before they have a permanent home means that that's a cost savings to the court and a cost savings to all of the taxpayers who support that court. The children then are also less likely to be re-abused and to have to re-enter the child welfare or court system. So the children are more likely to have a safe and a permanent home that they can grow up in and they can thrive and they can have their needs met in the way that they deserve.
Martha, does this say more about the efficacy of the court proceedings with a CASA person involved, or does it say more about the child's attitude from having a third party?
I think it's really the former. Our court system is terribly overburdened. We've added very few resources over the years, even though child abuse and neglect is growing, growing, growing. And the state workers who are also assigned to help are terribly constrained by heavy caseloads and time limitations. But our volunteers have time to spend one-on-one with these children. So I think the difference is made because it adds more time and resource to a very overburdened system and lets more information come forward. I'll give you a quick example if you want.
Please do.
We have a case that's been ongoing. Two young girls, they're school-age girls, African-American girls with sickle cell anemia. It's a very serious disease. It's a very painful disease. And proper care and medication are vital. Their mom was unable to provide that. She didn't have transportation. There were insurance issues. She had some mental health issues. And her ability to get those children to the doctor just wasn't there. Thankfully, one of their teachers hotlined the call, called and said these kids aren't getting the meds they need. Our CASA volunteer has made sure that those children have transportation to the doctor, that they're getting medication. These are kids who feel better every single day because this CASA volunteer is on that case.
And is that how it starts, Lois, sometimes with a hotline call? How do CASA volunteers get matched up with their corresponding children in cases?
Well, the hotline call certainly initiates the investigation that the child welfare agencies will do on this situation. If the children are found to have been abused and need to be placed into the custody of the respective state authorities, it then comes to the court's attention, and that's when the CASA gets involved. The court appointed part of it. It comes from the judges who hear those cases actually sign a court order initiating the CASA appointment. Then once our CASA staff receive that information, we look at our pool of available volunteers, consider the circumstances of the case as we know it to that point, and work to make the best match that we can between the case and the volunteer and to start that process.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jawalani LaFall. Our guests today run the court-appointed special advocates divisions of their respective counties, ACASA Executive Directors Martha Gershon of Jackson County and Lois Rice of Johnson and Wyandotte counties are here on the program today. Since we're speaking about respective counties, what are the different challenges or similarities from your areas? Let's begin with Martha Gershon of Jackson County.
Well, there are certainly more similarities than there are differences. In both cases, in all three of our counties, there's a significant rise in child abuse, both in incidence and in severity. There aren't enough foster homes. There aren't enough available adoptive parents. And the systems are terribly overburdened on both sides of the state line. There are some differences in terms of demographics. In Jackson County, we serve more African-American children. 58% of the kids that we help are Black. We serve a lot of biracial children. Lois can talk a little bit about Johnson and Wyandotte counties, but they tend to have more Latino families. So there are different demographics. And suburban abuse and urban abuse look a little different. But I would say for the most part, we both face very serious increases in child abuse, in the need for volunteers, in the need for people to step up and help.
Suburban abuse looks a little different. Can you expound upon that, Lois Rice? And particularly with Johnson County, you think more suburban.
Well, I think people would really be surprised to know, frankly, that the incidence of abuse in Johnson County has gone up even more dramatically than in some other parts of the metropolitan area in the last few years. Since 2008, there's been a 47% increase in the number of cases coming into the court's attention because of abuse or neglect. And as a result, the court has had to add a second judge to hear this overflow of cases.
In that specific case, with that specific spike in that specific county,
yes,
have any patterns been identified as to why?
The severity of the abuse does seem to be certainly increasing. More serious physical abuse, more serious sexual abuse. In fact, children abusing younger children, at a younger age, sexual abuse from one child to another, that's certainly spiked as well.
You guys collaborate from time to time and come together to help train the volunteers. Are there any characteristics specifically about our metro area? How does our metro area stack up against the nation when we look at those numbers? And what's unique about our metro area?
I think our metro area has been extremely forthcoming, both in terms of dollars to help support the agency and the staffs, and in terms of volunteers. Whenever we make a public appeal, which we are doing today, and saying we really need adults to help, our phones ring, our website clicks, and people really, truly respond in Kansas City. I think we have a heart for children here. Our CASAs are very large compared to other CASA agencies elsewhere in the country. It's because our counties are big. It's because, in some cases, our demographics skew low income. And it's also because we've been successful in raising money and recruiting volunteers to let us serve as many kids as we can. Let me give you some numbers. There are 3,600 children who will come into care in our three counties in 2012. That's based on historic numbers and the projected increase. Together, our two agencies right now only serve a third of those children.
Now, speaking of those numbers and speaking specifically, is this an increase in the instances of abuse or just an increase in the reported instances of abuse? Talk about that a little bit.
It's a really good question because we don't know much about unreported abuse. But this is what we do know. In tough economic times, the escape valves available to families just don't exist. The opportunity to get a babysitter might not exist. The opportunity to ask a friend to look after your kids. If you've lost their job, they've lost their job. Particularly in poorer communities, the safety net is so thin that in tough economic times, everybody's stretched. I'll give you an example of the kind of case we often see, which is a single mom with a couple of kids. Her boyfriend has moved into the house. He's helping pay rent. He's helping buy groceries. He may own the family car, so he may be responsible for letting her keep a job. And now he starts abusing the kids. They aren't his biological children. There might be a teenage girl in the home. There might be some perversion and some sexual predation going on. Or he might just think it's fun to beat the crap out of somebody else's kids. She's very compromised if she's dependent on him for rent, for food, for transportation. She really is between a rock and a hard place. And in tough economic times, we see a lot more of that kind of abuse going on.
Are there certain cases where a CASA volunteer is required to be involved? Therefore, the more severe the case, is that how CASA volunteers get involved?
Definitely. Since we don't have enough volunteers to serve the need, like Martha said, we only serve about a third of all the children who could benefit from a CASA in the court system. The children that do get a CASA come from circumstances that are more severe. And maybe that may be severity of the abuse that was inflicted upon them. It may be that instead of just two children in the family, there's five or six kids, and that's harder for the other parts of the system to keep a good handle on the situation for all of those children. There may be additional medical needs. One of the children may have a failure to thrive situation, or there may be developmental delays that the child is demonstrating, that having another set of eyes and ears to investigate and to find out and to track that situation is a benefit to the court, and it's going to make it more likely that the child will get the services they need. That's some of the reports and studies that have been done as well show that when a child has a CASA, they're more likely to get the needed services. The family is more likely to receive needed services as well. So, again, those are the kinds of families that most require an extra support.
We're on with Martha Gershon and Lois Rice, who are respectively executive directors of their CASA divisions in Jackson County and Johnson and Wyandotte counties. Beth writes in at centralstandard@kcr.org to ask, if CASA is only able to serve a third of the cases reported, what happens to the children you're aware of yet are unable to handle?
That's a really good question. In both of our court jurisdictions, children receive legal support from the Office of the Guardian Ad Litem, from court-appointed attorneys, and they definitely have state-supported social workers. But the intensity of the observation on the kids is less, and issues are less likely to be noted, and they will be in the system more for a greater period of time. So they still get services. But there are services that the state has to provide, and there's very limited money in both Missouri and Kansas. So if you're unlucky enough to be abused, you're luckier if you get a CASA volunteer.
Thank you for that question, Beth. Why is there such a dearth of volunteers? Is it the fact that there's a dearth of volunteers, or is it the fact that there is a rise in cases? How does that stack up?
Well, I would say that, by and large, both Martha and I, we always need more volunteers. But along with the need for volunteers, those volunteers have to be supervised. We have to have staff to oversee, provide input and guidance. So in addition to having a good number of volunteers, we also need to have the financial support so that we can make sure those volunteers are properly screened. There's a quadruple background check that each potential applicant must undergo. We want to make sure that anyone who comes to be a volunteer is going to be a safe experience for that child. They all go through 30 hours of mandatory pre-service training. So those both require staff to implement that training. And then once they've completed that and they are matched directly with a child or sibling group, that's when it takes the supervising staff to oversee their work on the case, provide input, answer their questions, help explain to them just what the process of this court system is. So really, it has to be a really good match between having enough volunteers and having the financial support to make sure those volunteers are providing quality services.
It sounds like a three-tiered problem here, or a three-tiered issue, or three-tiered challenge, however you want to put it. There's three factors at play. Funding is one big one, and the lack of volunteers, and the rise in cases.
That's absolutely right.
How do you attack those three?
And also, I want to say that the need for volunteers is especially acute in two demographic cases. We are desperate for more African-American volunteers. On the Jackson County side, 58% of the kids we serve are African-American. About 10% of our volunteers are. And the extent to which kids would like to be served by people who look like them, who might come from the community, who might have had similar experiences in school or neighborhoods, we would love to provide that match. So African-American volunteers are a critical need. And on both sides of the state line, we need men. Women are more likely to volunteer in our community, and they're more likely to volunteer for kids. But half the kids we serve are boys, some of them teenagers, some of them infants and toddlers, but they need male role models. So the extent to which our plea can go out to those demographics, I'm not saying Caucasian women can't help kids. They've been helping kids for centuries. But we really need African Americans and women and men to help step up and help these kids.
So what does the training entail?
Lois, do you want to talk about the training?
Sure. The training entails an overview, really, about the situations the volunteers may encounter. They're going to get information about child abuse and neglect, what some of the indicators are, what some of the results of that behavior results may be from a child who has experienced abuse or neglect. Substance abuse, understanding of what the dynamics are in a family where substance abuse is a predominant factor. Cultural diversity. Help me out, Martha.
Well, and we also talk a lot separately in Kansas and Missouri about what our court systems look like and what our social service agencies look like, because those are different on the two sides of the state line. We don't just throw folks into a system and expect them to figure it out. We train them and say, this is what hearings you'll see. This is the timeline that a child goes through once they're in the system. And we load them up with information about what to do if you have a question, what to do if you're in trouble. I'll tell you another thing we're starting to train a lot about, which is substance abuse. More than half of the cases of abuse and neglect in our metro area have a substance abuse component, either alcohol or illegal drugs or possibly even legal prescription medications. We do a lot of training on how to identify that, what resources are available to help. If we can get a mom clean and sober, she can get her kids back. But we need to know about the resources in our community that help make that happen. So, boy, we train them on a lot of things.
Martha and Lois, in the process of researching the show, we've heard from some volunteers that say interaction with foster parents can make volunteering somewhat onerous. What's being done to address this problem, and are there cases where the barrier to entry, the barrier to efficiency, a foster parent can hinder that?
Well, we certainly, foster parents are a key component to this whole dynamic and to the whole situation that the children are placed in. So they're very, very valued resource, and we know that the vast majority of foster parents do a fantastic job under difficult circumstances themselves. We want to partner with the foster parents. We want to try to establish an agreement where the child, the foster parent, and the child can have access to the CASA volunteer so that we can make sure that that home is a safe environment. So we'll do what we can to work with that foster parent. If need be, we may involve the child welfare agency that oversees that foster home to see if they can help us come together and develop some ways that we can have access. Maybe the CASA will visit the home at the same time as the child welfare worker does so that we can try to make it a more amenable situation for those foster parents who are having difficulties with that.
The question you ask is a good one. This is not volunteer work for the timid. Some of the parties in the cases are sometimes unhappy, and some of them have sometimes committed terrible, terrible crimes against children. But if you think about a kid living in a home, it's hard to believe that there's not a caring adult who's willing to visit that home and help make it safe for that child. So our volunteers do heroic work, and they tell us it's the most meaningful part of their lives.
So what's the first step in getting involved?
You need to call us. It's www.casakc.org, and our phone number is 877-708-2272. And both that website and that phone number will let you pick which side of the state line you want to help on.
And if you missed that information, we have that information up on our website at kcur.org as well, where you can catch a podcast of today's show as well. Our guests run the court-appointed special advocates divisions of their respective counties. CASA Executive Directors Martha Gershon of Jackson County and Lois Rice of Johnson and Wyandotte Counties. Thank you so much for joining us here today on Central Standard.
Thank you. Appreciated it.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we talk to a visiting artist from South Africa about the program he's putting together for local children with a local artist. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabulani LaFall. Nico Poco, a visual artist from South Africa, is known for his loud, colorful, busy, but meticulously drawn visual arts pieces. He's now visiting Kansas City to help young artists find and cultivate their artistic sensibilities. Mr. Poco is here as part of the Leiden International Artist Exchange Program, and he's here along with his host artist, Shane Evans. Mr. Evans, Mr. Poco, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, brother.
Now, tell us about the township in South Africa, Mr. Poco, where you grew up.
I grew up in the township of Gwatema in Springs. It's in the east of Johannesburg. It's called East Rand. Where do I start? It's a long story, but I'll just be brief, given the time that we have here. The township I grew up in is one that has a lot of musicians and artists. In fact, we have about three or four well-celebrated artists in my township who, when I grew up, motivated me to be here today, to be where I am. And another thing about them is they take art quite seriously from very early. And another thing is, it was a very political township. So if you have to be an artist there, you had to be political. And something that I'm working hard to stop being.
We had a South African writer on here earlier, Zakes Mda, you might have heard of.
Zakes Mda.
Zakes Mda.
Mda. That's it.
And yeah. And he talked about artists over in South Africa having political origins and political motivations and catalysts in their work. He also does some painting in addition to writing. What made you choose visual art as a particular medium through which to express yourself?
Well, first, because at the time I was born, it had to do what Brazakes told you it does, to be political, because every day was political. It was more political than anything. So you would use art as a language of expression, as a medium of trying to reach out to people you wouldn't otherwise, because of the restrictions you had under apartheid. You would have to reach a lot of people, and the medium you could use instead of talking was art, because art speaks it speaks silently, so to speak. Yeah.
And did you do that mainly through murals or graffiti or paintings? How did you start?
Well, you wouldn't go murals. You'd be arrested for a very long time. Right. We'd be the youngest the youngest politicians at Robben Island. Graffiti was best because we were not even supposed to talk about people like Mandela. So if you have a spray can in your backpack, you know, you can just release Mandela quickly and run, you know, long live Biko and run, you know. But with the graffiti, you'd have to spend time. And yeah, I mean, those guys were not easy at that time. They would, like, get tough with you.
So for you, it just started with an easel and paintings.
Well, easels were a luxury I could not afford at that time. I mean, you know, easels were a luxury. I would do stuff on the floor, which is something I'm still doing. I'm still obsessed with painting on the floor. In the studios, though, you know.
And what are your influence? How did your style develop to what it is today?
Well, there is a musician in me that at first was more strong and powerful. You see, I'll tell you what, being an artist, because of the material and the lack of money to afford it, it is not always easy to express that talent when you are young. But singing, you can sing anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a mic. You don't need a piano, even if you don't have it. You can always clap your hands, tap your feet, and sing. You see, so the musician in me, it manifested earlier and first is in the talents that I have. Now, that guy influenced the visual artist that I am, which now I am here doing my best to bring both of them together, because the musician feels left behind sometimes. And he's like, you're always on the visual guy, which you discovered late. He's not aware that these guys were both in me. So I'm combining the two, the visual and the musician.
Now, speaking of the visual and the musician, we have Mr. Shane Evans here. Tell us about how this Kansas City, South Africa connection started. You went over there first in 2008 and met with Mr. Poco. Tell us a little bit about that.
Man, I mean, first I want to thank the Linda Lighten, Lighten Foundation, Leop Grant, and the Kansas City Artists Coalition, because that was kind of the kickoff to it all. I had made a decision in my heart to get down to Lesotho, made a connection through the Baylor Institute, and then went down to Lesotho, which is inside of South Africa. And Nico and I, we started to dialogue, you know, through email and getting to know one another. He knew that I was coming that way. So a little over a month in Southern Africa, stopped in Johannesburg, and that's where we met first. Then on my trip back after going up north to Botswana, came back to Johannesburg, picked up Nico, and then we went down to Lesotho, and then we worked with the children that I had worked with in the first portion. So that's our that was our first meeting.
What was it like meeting Shane Evans for the first time?
It was amazing, Nico, because it did not look like the guy I've been communicating with over the internet. That's what we posted. I said, you don't look like that guy. And I said, you don't look like the one either. Because when I got to want to come here, what I do is, okay, the influence behind my work, which goes back to your question as well, is music. You know, it's music-inspired art. Okay. Now, I wanted to look into the United States of America, which places and spaces that are not so loud. Like, I know loud cities here, like New York, L.A., I know cities that are loud and everybody in the world knows them better than the art. Kansas City is not so popular. A lot of my friends was, where's that?
A lot of people in America say elaborate. Where's that too. So.
But then it's good for my work.
It is good.
You know, what I will tell you is it's good for my work, because when you research on where to work and get more inspiration, I mean, I got to know that Kansas City is the city of the blues, and the blues are very heavy and serious. I mean, remember where we come from now. In terms of where I told you, we grew up under a system that made you political and conscious.
Yes.
Okay, and the blues, when you pick that up, you find a lot of that. That's and that is good source of material for one's work.
That's
to have meaning.
Good.
You know, jazz.
Jazz.
You know, I mean...
Yeah, jazz, definitely.
13, 14 Kansas years ago, I went to New Orleans, the birthplace of jazz, and that was also good for my work, because it helps me grow in what I'm doing, in finding... I mean, we listen to a lot of jazz, and this I got to know about in my township. My township is well known for, like, guys who are jazz-listening guys, and I'm talking serious jazz here. We even make jokes about some jazz musicians, you know? Like, oh, you play Kenny G, man, you should hear Kenny Garrett. You know, we have such jokes. You know, we have such jokes, and...
Don't get me started on Kenny G.
We love these guys, but we just make jokes, you know? Right. Guys make jokes everywhere.
Of course, always.
Speaking of music that is most certainly not Kenny G, we're going to hear a musical number here. Tell us about it. Set it up for us, Shane Evans.
Appreciate it, man. Appreciate it. So, you know, Olu's Dream, we've mentioned that, talked about that on this program, and it's coming to life. It's coming to life, actually. Plug it, June. And this is the first time I mentioned it, June 8th at the Kansas City Library. We're going to do Olu's Dream, the musical. So this piece is called The Dream Theme, and Nico is offered some of his voice to this piece, so we're gonna.
Now you're gonna sing in Zulu.
Yeah.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Exactly.
Son, it's time to dream, and I know you don't know what I mean. Your imagination has no boundaries. You can be what you wanna be. You can be a Superman or an astronaut. You can ride a whale or eat anything you want. You can be the winner of the big race. when you wake, the dreams you can take with you when you dream, all who dream, be all that you can be. And when the sun rises, bring these dreams to life. And I know you don't want to sleep to the sun. You want to stay awake and have a good time. And trust me when I say you will have a good time tonight in your dreams.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. What you just heard was the vocal stylings of Nico Poco, a visual artist from South Africa who enjoys all types of music and art. He's here as part of a program to help inner city kids find their artistic art and comfort zones and heart, and also exhibiting some of his work, accompanied on guitar and additional vocals by Shane Evans. It's called The Dream Theme, based on
the Olu's
your
dream. Yeah.
Illustrated child's book, Olu's Dream.
That is correct.
That is now being turned into a play.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
What are the similarities, Nico, that you see in the children here in America versus the children you work with in South Africa?
Is that they are all willing to take their talents to higher levels of seriousness. Okay. The one thing I've noticed is that kids are always ambitious, and I love being involved with them, which is the reason why I work with Shane, because I got to discover that he has that too. So the ambitions children have, it doesn't matter where you are in the world, is they want to see themselves somewhere. And in being that, they help and teaches you to get to remember that you also have the dreams and the ambitions and the goals and the ideals that they have. And, you know, that I pick up in kids everywhere. You know, the similarities is that they have the talent and they want to see themselves taking the talent somewhere.
What similarities do you see, Shane? You just recently came back from Uganda as well.
Yes.
What similarities do you see in working with children here in America and children abroad?
Sure.
And what part did you play in bringing Nico over here?
I mean, you know, the similarities are that they're children. I mean, I hate to sound so like, you know, like matter of fact about it, but they're children. Like, you know, and what does that mean? Every individual has an experience with the child. And so that, you know, the hook, I guess, what one might say in this song is, you know, bring these dreams to life. At any age, you know, we got to ignite that passion. And so that every child that I've come across all over the world has that same, you know, passion for that dream inside. My part of getting Nico over was really just to extend my hand, you know, there, as from brother to brother, you know, because that's who we are, and to, you know, create a space to really say, this is who you should speak to. And then he did the rest, you know. So it's really the extension of a welcome is how that really opened the door for this journey.
What types of projects are you hoping to get involved with children here? What types of art projects did you do over there, and how would you incorporate that here, Nico?
Mostly when I work with kids back at home is, you see, South Africa is getting somewhere. It's not that long. And kids in our times are in a best place. I mean, a best place. You know, best place.
Hmm.
Best place.
Best?
Now, yeah, because they don't have to go through a lot that some of us did.
True.
And with that, I see them being, there's a saying that your students will be better than you.
Mm.
Expect that, because otherwise, what's the point of teaching them?
True.
What I have noticed about children in Africa is they want to travel the world a lot, an opportunity they never had got to have. You know, they see the world as some place somewhere else other than on Earth.
Yes.
You know, so I make it possible that if I can be there, then you can be there too.
That's good.
You know,
yeah.
You know, you touch them and you get involved with murals. Look, we do a lot of murals because with kids, they cannot do stuff that they can put in galleries all the time and get people to come and see. So when you put stuff with kids in the public, it's even best because anybody can own that.
Yes. You know? Shane, you guys did a mural over there.
We went into a small community center. We met a gentleman over there who's working with children. And, you know, the extension of working with children is you got one has to move their own feet, heart, and hands to the children. So this gentleman was, gathering his children inside of what he called the community center, which was really a house. And so then from there, that's where Nico and we got together. We put out canvases on the floor. Matter of fact, I have those at the studio. I brought those pieces. So the dialogue, continues. It's an extension of that dialogue from those children on canvas or paper or walls or however we can get it out there.
Uh-huh. Nico, why is it important to you to spread African values, music, and ethics and traditional ways of life through your artwork? Why is that important to you, the African aesthetic?
Oh, it's a story I must tell, you see, and that's the importance of being an artist in my time, in this space. I would say that again. And the importance of it is to tell African stories that I feel my forefathers never got to have a chance to tell. They can use me to do that, you know, because what I know is this talent did not fall from a tree like an apple. It comes from somewhere, and it might come from people who never got to have a chance to say it for themselves.
Yes.
And they use me to do that. And look, music reaches people, which is what I like more than art. So in combining the two, you reach out to a lot of people. I've already met more musicians here in Kansas City than artists, as in visual artists. Fortunately, because I have Shane, who's got both, like me, the musician, you know, the creative spirit of the painter and the musician. Mm. I get to even meet more on the visual side, too.
Bringing Shane in, how is visual art expressed musically?
That's a great question. I don't see any boundaries between the things. You know, we tend to compartmentalize and say that we are this and we are that. But the reality is, like, when I pick up my guitar, I'm painting with musical, you know, notes. I am, like, listening to the vibrations the same as I'm looking at the vibrations of color when I put them down. Because colors do vibrate. If you put, you know, two complements together, they start to vibrate your eye cones, you know, and it stimulates you in a certain way, very much like music. When you listen to notes, it stimulates something inside of you. So they go together, and I, you know, I recognize that, and I don't put a division. I mean, I did for a long time, but like Nico was saying, but you know, once I recognized that they speak together and they work in harmony, it was easy.
Is there a rhythm to a way you compose
all the time. I even have a wording for it. I call it notes and strokes.
Yeah.
You know, paint and play and paint. You know, the art of making music and the music of making art. You know, I'm not like going to elaborate on that because it speaks by itself. That line.
Yes.
You know, the two are common and the same. They differ perhaps in notes, patterns, and rhythms. You know, and strokes. You know, some strokes are thick, some are thin.
Mm-hmm.
Some strokes are hard, some are soft. Mm-hmm. Some notes are like that too.
Do you play music in the background when you paint? And if so,
all the time.
What type of music? Whatever strikes you.
I'll tell you what. You can never bore me with music because I don't limit it. I don't want any boundaries to music. Look, there's so many musicians in the world, and if you get to, I mean, so far I've had close to like 16 or 17. Groups of bands and artists here in Kansas City within the 2 weeks that I never got a chance to have known about.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you listen to people who compile music from around the world. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to put brand names here. You know, Putumayo Records.
Mm.
You know, you get to listen to music from virtually everywhere. You get a guy who does in Russia what in South Africa Sibongile Khumalo would do, in America the Blind Boys of Alabama would do.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't have a limit to the music that must inspire me, because then I would be not doing my art justice.
You wouldn't. You know? I agree.
You know, music is eternity. It goes on and on.
It's exactly. I feel the same way. You know, like somebody will ask me what kind of music. I'm like, well, every kind. And then, you know, even I'll sometimes joke, like, you know, what kind of music you have on your iPod? Well, I got everything but polka. No, I mean, I'm going to quantify that. Not to say that I wouldn't listen to some good polka if somebody hit me with it. But, you know, that's not it. That just happens to not be in my iPod. But there have been musics that, you know, genres of music that I've expanded into. You know, country, I would have never listened to that many, many years ago. But now it's, you know, it's a vibrant dialogue, you know, through storytelling. That's what it's all about.
The storytelling component of both music and art, how prevalent is that in your process, Nico?
As in
the storytelling element.
How do I get to that? It's continuous, if I may say. As in the stories that I'm telling through my music and art? Is that what you're asking me?
That's exactly what I'm asking.
it's continuous, because I'll tell you what. The medium we use, which is visual or art, and are mediums that have, like books, have a quality to last long even when we are gone, you know. So the story will continue even when one is no longer here, because it is already documented and it has been left there. Mm-hmm. Now, I know a lot of musicians who are no longer here in flesh, but they are always here in spirit. Mm-hmm. We still celebrate them as if mm-hmm. we can still touch them, you know. So I want that to also remain into why I'm here and why am I doing this. Because, look, it's not always easy to come up with that kind of telling story and expect it to be what it is, or to have the support you deserve for it all the time.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned meeting a lot of artists here in Kansas City, a lot of musical artists. What are some of your favorite things about Kansas City so far?
It's the warmth and the friendliness of the people. I think mm-hmm. that's what made mm-hmm. Kansas City unique.
Yeah. No, exactly.
You know, it's very warm and it's very friendly and it's very tolerant people who you don't have to say too much before they know what you are about to say.
I agree.
Smart people, so to speak, you know. Yeah. And I'm forever so grateful to have idealized that in my head. Mm-hmm. And have to, it's a long way home, and have to travel all the way only to find it's true. Because all the time when you plan a journey, you put things down, you know, you put the map down, you put plans down. This is what I want to achieve. And I've achieved most of that without having to say too much to people.
Yeah, no, that's good.
What were you expecting when you came in? Shane will come in later.
What I was expecting?
What were you expecting of Kansas City?
I was expecting to
came?
Find artists who will be very helpful and useful for my work, and I have.
And you have, see? No, and that's,
so you got what you expected.
That's it.
You know, and that's beautiful, because for me, having Nico here is like reignited my recognition of how good a city this is to be in regards to the support that we have and get as artists, and the way that artists support one another inside of this community. You know, the New Yorks and the Los Angeleses, and people will often ask me, well, what kept you here in Kansas City? And well, I'm like, why wouldn't I want to stay in this town? Like, we have to make this town become, we have to have the expectation of, like what Nico said, for him to come all the way, he had the expectation that he would connect with people on all levels, et cetera. And that's what happened. You know, he realized that experience forward. You know, he created it.
Plus, a lot of what we hear on this show and in general, and myself in the community with artists in general, are that the New Yorks and Los Angeles and Paris, those are art markets.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas here, it's more based on process.
That's right. That's right.
Art ovens. We bake art here.
And then send it on out.
You bake it, cook it here, and send
that's
it on
it.
Out.
That's it. You see, because even the Kansas City Artist Coalition is not so popular back in my country.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
And when I got to know about them, when I got here, my expectations were filled. You know, they took me seriously from day one.
From day
you
one.
Know, Janet Simpson and Marisa. I mean, the work they're doing is amazing.
It's
to
great.
Me, they're like angels of first degree. And they make also my journey here worth it. You know, they make it extremely worth it because they're there, you know, second by second. You know, make sure this artist is here for what he's here for.
Exactly.
And he's getting it done, you know, he's getting it all
support.
Together. And
support.
You need things like that to, you know,
I
to
agree.
Move forward.
Now, you'll be discussing your new body of work created at the Kansas City Coalition this Wednesday, April 4th at 6 p.m. What can people who aren't familiar with your work expect?
Look, this is another one. I'm going to be very honest with you. I don't always talk about my work as in why is this that. What I want is for it to speak for it. Look, now this is my book. You know, my art is my book. If I have written it, I don't always ask somebody to ask me, what's the book about? Read it. Read it. I wrote it. You know, it's already written. Exactly. What I'm going to talk about is talk about how that came about and why it came about.
Yeah, exactly.
And the rest, the paintings, I want to speak for themselves. Then that will be what the painting is meant for. Let the painting speak.
Exactly.
Let the artwork sing.
Yes.
The music I've been picking up in Kansas City.
These particular works that you are exhibiting, what was the motivation for these particular works?
City of the Blues, it's music. You know, I'm happy when I got here, my computer was off for almost a week. So I couldn't listen to anything I know. I couldn't listen to anything I know to refresh my soul and come up with fresh stuff from a fresh environment.
Yeah.
I mean, I banned from the day one. I couldn't sleep, you know, because of the delays I had on my way here. Mm. And with that, I couldn't waste time, you know. I have sculptures that are made of found objects. Those objects started singing at me right at the first moment when I hopped in that space. You know?
Yeah.
The following day, Janet was like, wow, you just got here.
Yeah, right.
I was like, well, it's time to work.
That's what I'm here for.
Man, gotta do what a man's gotta do gotta in
do
this
it.
Space.
Gotta do it.
Our guest is Nico Poco, a visual artist from South Africa, here as part of a program to help inner city kids find their artistic heart and comfort zones. He also has an exhibition opening and lecture this Wednesday, April 4th, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Kansas City Arts Coalition's Gallery at 201 Wyandotte in downtown Kansas City. And we also had Shane Evans, our other guest here today, children's book illustrator and musician. Olu's Dream, the musical, is coming soon in June.
Yes.
Thank you both for coming to the show.
Thanks for having us.
And tune in tomorrow as we talk about new music, but with a twist. We'll be joined by KCUR's panel of music hosts. You know them as Renee, Chuck, and Bill. You have to find out more tomorrow. Plus, our Central Standard music curator, Miles Bonney, will be part of that show as well. Our show is produced by Andrea Salenzi with help from Charlie Upchurch. Up to Date is next with a look at scorecasting, the emerging science of how sports are played and games are won. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.